Teresa Reyes from the Department of Labor and the Office of the Minister. Also wish to welcome the advocate, Mr. Guy, who will be assisting Honorable Hollis today, and all the members. And everybody is here in the house. Well, I don't know all the faces that are here, but you are all welcome. The agenda today, Zalani, can you read the agenda for us?
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, everybody. The agenda for today, Wednesday, 20 May, is as follows. Opening and welcome, which Chairperson is up there. Apology, adoption of agenda, briefing by the Hollis on the private members' amendment proposed on the LRA, legal opinion by the parliamentary legal advisor, comments by the Department of Labor, deliberations on the way forward on the bill. Close attending.
Members, that's the agenda of the day. Are we happy with it? Honorable Bahrain, who's seconding? Honorable Loliwa, so we are adopting that agenda for today. Any apologies for today?
Only one apology I have just received to share is the Honorable Ms. Tomwan.
Is it a letter?
Yes, it says that she will not be able to attend the Labour Portfolio Committee said because she lost her uncle.
President, is there any letter? Oh, yeah. Oh, okay, there's a letter. Okay. Honorable Hollis, so there is only one apology, then we will offer you an opportunity to take us through. Over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. And welcome to everybody. I didn't expect such a big crowd, but I'm quite glad that the Department of Labor is taking it quite seriously. That means there must be at least some merit in it, otherwise they might have not come. So I'm very glad they brought a full team today. And I just want to thank everybody who's helped over the years. It's been a 5-year process, so thank you to the parliamentary legal team. Thank you, my colleagues in the DA and others who have helped. I've titled my little talk today, and I only get one shot at this, so forgive me if it's a little bit longer than normal. The bill that could have saved some lives at Marikana. Why this bill? Allow me to read a short extract from Eyewitness News journalist Chantel September from October 2012. The article is titled, Satawa Strike Victim Declared Brain Dead. The man was badly hurt when he struck with stones, allegedly by Satawa strikers last week. His name is Gary Stewart. The man who was severely injured after the truck he was traveling in was stoned, allegedly by strikers, has been declared brain dead. Gary Stewart was in the passenger seat when a rock struck his head on Wednesday. A 40-year-old was busy with routine deliveries when the stoning occurred near Borchard's Quarry turn-off on the N2 highway. Doctors at Vincent Colotti Hospital have now declared him brain dead. His sister, Michelle Fisher, told Eyewitness News the family is at breaking point. They are planning to turn off the life support at 6 a.m. on Tuesday, and he will be laid to rest. The 3-week-old strike has been marred by violence in KwaZulu-Natal, Gauteng, and the Western Cape. At least 35 trucks have been torched since the beginning of the strike in Ekurhuleni alone. At the same time, Satawa has threatened to intensify its strike later this week. That was October 2012. On the 9th of October 2012, in a new article, the news came that he had died. His sister, Michelle Fisher, was interviewed by Zara Nicholson of the Independent Papers. She says, and I quote, "We have just put ourselves through months of pain. He had no brain activity. The stone flew through the windscreen, hitting Stewart on the back of his head. love to hate the people who did this, but it's not in my nature. Would I like justice to be done? I don't know. Nothing will bring my brother back. She would most miss her brother's daily calls and watching sport with him. Life will be lonely without him, and the reality is that I still have to go home and see the truck standing in our yard, and I don't know how I will cope. Her husband, Henry Fisher, said, I'm very angry and disappointed that the perpetrators will get away with what they did. For something like this to happen to Gary is very hard to accept. He wouldn't hurt anyone ever, never had a bad word to say about anyone. When we decided to donate his organs, we said it was exactly the thing he would have wanted to do. In that same year, just a few days before, on the 28th of September, as the opposition Labour spokesperson, I put out a statement myself, which read the following. Unions involved in ongoing transport and freight industry strikes must be held liable for damages and violence perpetrated by its members. The level of violence and damage to property relating to these strikes continue to escalate. Some of the disturbing incidents reported on include in Nyanga, Cape Town, two trucks were set alight. A working truck driver was beaten up in Durban. Truck drivers in Johannesburg and Durban threw stones at passing trucks, burned a number of trucks, and assaulted non-striking truck drivers. Three people have been hospitalized thus far, and several have sustained injuries. A working driver in Essequin sustained serious head wounds while trying to drive away from protesters, and subsequently collided with a car and then smashed into a tree. Two Ekurhuleni workers were allegedly assaulted badly with knobkerries and shamboks when they tried to flee the scene. Three more Ekurhuleni drivers were attacked and forced to abandon their vehicles by striking truck drivers who also torched their truck and van. This violence and undemocratic process of grievances cannot be tolerated. The DA's private members bill, this one that's in front of you today, recently referred to the Labour Committee for consideration, seeks to amend the Labour Relations Act and propose that unions be held accountable for their members' misconduct during strikes. This will go a long way to protect non-striking workers and the general public from violence and intimidation, and will protect public and private property from malicious damage during strike action. End quote. This bill that I'm presenting today to the Labour Committee is that exact bill. It might have saved lives, including this Mr. Gary Stewart. I've worked on getting it through the parliamentary process for almost 5 years now. It is a bill that could have saved many lives at Marikana if it were implemented. And here's the reason why. A judge could have declared the strikes at Marikana unprotected and forced all of the parties to arbitration. And arbitration happens in a room, not on the streets or in the field. It is a bill that could protect the flower sellers in Adderley Street who last week had all their flowers stolen, their stalls damaged by some workers rampaging through the streets of Cape Town. It's high time that we took this bill seriously. Chairperson, the pendulum has swung too far in the direction of organized labor, who seem to encourage violence sometimes, and now the pendulum needs to swing a little bit back the other way to balance the rights and the responsibilities on the streets of South Africa. On the 14th of September 2012, we received the results of the Kasatu Workers Survey, which says, and I quote here from Carol Payson of the Business Day, half of Congress of South African trade union members polled in a 2012 workers survey to view violence by workers as necessary during a strike if a desired result is to be achieved. That's quite a statement coming from a Kasatu survey. The survey conducted by Kasatu's research institute, Naledi, and covering more than 3,000 workers in 37 districts, contains a variety of findings that cast light on the unfolding dynamics in the labor movement. In his organizational report to Kasatu Congress, which begins on Monday, General Secretary Zweli Zimavavi says, the findings and attitudes to violence during strikes tell us that we have a problem on our hands. As you know, in 2012, he was Secretary General. The survey was followed up by focus groups which further explored the legitimacy of using violence. One participant is quoted as saying, violence during strikes is appropriate because it is a result of the pain that workers feel. Another one said, a strike is the last resort for workers after negotiations fail, wages. But we use violence. We use violence to make sure that the employer listens to our demands fast so that we can go back to work. That's Carol Payton of the Business Today quoting from that story. This pendulum needs to swing back to the middle so that this kind of understanding of the need for violence is reined in. That's my introduction. The process of this bill, it has been, I think, a labor of love for almost 5 years in Parliament to get this bill to this committee. My original Labor Relations Amendment Bill was tabled at the committee for private members' legislative proposals and petitions on the 5th of October 2010. On the 20th of September 2012, the chairperson of the Private Members Committee finally gave in to pressure as a result of the Jarvis Concord ruling and allowed this bill to be debated by that committee and approved for forwarding for consideration by the Labour Committee of Parliament in 2012. Honourable Nyakemba, sorry, Mr. Nyakemba may remember he was the Honourable Nyakemba at that time that it arrived at the Labour Committee. Unfortunately, subsequently, in the case of Mario Ambrosini versus the Speaker, the Constitutional Court ruled that this private members' committee in Parliament was unconstitutional and was acting like a censorship board. I'm paraphrasing, of course. The committee was shut down by Parliament and all bills in process were sent back to the proposers of the bills to start over again in the new process. When the brown envelopes arrived at my office with this bill in it, I was quite disillusioned. No private members' bills were ever supported by Parliament or the government in the fourth Parliament. None. Not one. After the fifth Parliament convened and the new process had been put in place for private members' bills, the so-called interim process, I had to resuscitate this bill, get it all rewritten in the new format and submit it again. I delivered it yet again to the Speaker on the 13th of October 2014. And thank you to our parliamentary legal advisors for their assistance with that. It was gazetted in the Government Gazette on the 5th of November 2014. It has taken until today, 20th of May 2015, to finally get the opportunity to present this bill to the Labour Committee to get a decision to take the bill further, and I thank the Chairperson for the opportunity today. That's 4 years, 7 months, and 15 days just to get Parliament to discuss the contents of this bill. The purpose of the bill. This amendment seeks to protect non-striking workers and the general public from violence and intimidation and to protect public and private property from malicious destruction during strike action. This legislation would make unions liable for, among others, penalties and damages for the illegal and undisciplined behavior of individual members, such as riot damage. Such penalties would be imposed upon unions or indeed any party to a strike if prescribed good practice is not followed. Did you hear the if? The penalties are imposed if good practice is not followed during legitimate strike action. The Labour Court would also be empowered to declare the cessation of a protected strike or refer the protected strike for arbitration in the event that it has become unacceptably violent. And here's where Marikana, I think, comes in, as well as many of these other violent strikes. Court could refer this protected strike for arbitration if it has become unacceptably violent. The right to strike is enshrined in our constitution and is an essential component of our labour legislation that allows disenfranchised workers to take legitimate industrial action as a means of both voicing their concerns and bargaining with employers. Equally important, and here's the point, equally important is the right of those people who wish to work to be free to do so without fear of intimidation or violence. Likewise, neither the state nor the private sector should have to fork out more damage to property resulting from union action. However, South Africa has been rocked by serious strike action, which has resulted in deaths, acts of violence, and intimidation against fellow workers and members of the general public, and widespread destruction of property. In many instances, we have also seen members involved in obstructing the provision of vital public services, particularly those in the public health sector. This bill seeks to amend the Labour Relations Act of 1995 by making unions partly responsible for the illegal actions during strikes. The key points of the proposal are as follows. Number one, registered unions should be expected to take steps to prevent, repair, or remedy injury to a person or loss or damage to property caused by strike action. Unions will be made responsible for damage, loss, or injury as a result of strike action that the union either expressly or tacitly endorsed or facilitated if, and here again is the if is crucial, if they do not take reasonable steps to prevent violence from occurring. So the aim of the bill is to encourage organizations to take reasonable steps, and only if they don't take the reasonable steps do these other facilities kick in. Union responsibility is presumed in cases where there is loss, damage, or injury arising from strike action if it has not been, if it has been proven that a member committed an offence or caused damage during the strike action. Courts would be given the power to issue orders, award damages, declare if and when a strike is no longer protected, and to refer a dispute to arbitration as though it were a dispute in an essential service. While we are cognizant of the fact that the law has adequate provisions in place to charge individual members of the public, including striking union members, with crimes such as damage to property or acts of aggression or assault, we believe that extending the law to hold unions accountable for the behavior of their members during an approved strike would advance the interests of justice and carry with it an array of practical benefits. Firstly, it is a matter of principle that an organizational body, when breaching the law while carrying out one of its regular functions, should be regarded as a juristic person and held liable for its actions. Just as a petroleum company, not an individual staff member of the petroleum company, but just as a petroleum company should be held liable to pay damages for an oil spill, a union should be held responsible for breaches of the law during strike action. In other words, an amendment of this nature to the Labor Relations Act would advance the principle of accountability. Secondly, this proposal would be, I believe, have a profound net effect. The fact is that both union bosses and members know that acts of violence during mass action are difficult for the police to investigate and pinpoint to specific members. The upshot is that there is little existing disincentive against acts of violence. A law of this kind would incentivize unions and union office bearers to take, and here's the quote again, all reasonable steps to avoid such lawlessness. During the previous public sector strike, the Sergeant called its actions peaceful, lawful, and orderly. They claimed that they would not tolerate or condone any violent or threatening behavior, and that the organization prided itself on its members' high levels of discipline in strikes and demonstrations. Though all the evidence may suggest otherwise, the salient point is this: if union bosses agree that strikers must be orderly and peaceful, then they should have no problem signing into legislation a bill that seeks to further that aim of peace. The objects of this bill, recent concerns have centered around the level of strike action and the escalation of violence, which is costly to owners of property and businesses and the threat of personal safety to persons subject to the conduct of participants in violent strike action. According to the South African Institute of Race Relations 2013 South African Survey, between 2010 and 2012, strike-related fatalities increased from 7 to 60. Injuries increased from 31 to 150, and arrests increased from 271 to 643. What were the unions doing to stop this disproportionate rise in violence? In 2013, the total number of strikes went from 9 to 14, with over 50% of recorded strike action being characterized as unprotected and often subject to incidents of violence and destruction of property. Statistics from recent protest action in the metal engineering sectors last year show that the first 2 weeks of the strike, 246 cases of intimidation were reported, 50 violent incidents, and 85 cases of vandalism. Although the Act recognizes the right to lawful strike action, a proper balance must be struck between the right of workers to engage in a legal strike and minimizing the incidence of violent protests resulting in malicious damage to property or injury to persons. Adjustments need to be made within the labor system in order to find this balance. Though the Regulation of Gatherings Act 193 imposes restrictions and prohibitions upon gatherings and demonstrations that cause riot damage to third parties, the current provisions within the legislation fail to address instances where damage caused to persons and property by strike strikers in the course of promoting the object of a strike does not necessarily occur within the gathering or demonstration. Indeed, the harm caused by strikers often occurs underhandedly at strike breakers' homes and as strike participants move to and from strike locations, and damage to persons and property therefore occurring outside the formal strictures of a sanctioned strike or gathering, yet acting in furtherance of the union-supported collection action. This bill seeks to provide a statutory duty on trade unions to take, and here's that phrase again, reasonable steps to prevent harm to persons and property. The parliamentary legal advice, if I may comment on that. My original draft of the Labour Relations Amendment was placed before the parliamentary legal advisers, and they suggested changes that changed the original intent of the bill. I've taken legal advice from senior counsel and attorneys who have spent a lifetime working on labour legislation on this matter. My proposal had three objects. The first was to place registered trade unions, their officials and office bearers under a statutory duty to take reasonable steps to prevent harm to person and property arising out of acts and omissions constituting a direct breach of contract or crime committed in contemplation or furtherance of union-supported collective action. The second was to impose an onus of proof on registered trade unions to demonstrate that the steps taken were reasonable in circumstances where collective action supported by them have produced the unlawful results I have referred to. And the third was to give the Labour Court the jurisdiction to lift the protections given to lawful strikes falling foul of the substantive provisions referred to, thereby empowering employers to dismiss or otherwise discipline strikers, and in addition to award damages against the trade union in question. One of the issues that I wrestled with in drafting the provision was whether the duty should be imposed on all trade unions or only those that are properly registered. I concluded that the limitation to registered trade unions only was probably justified on the basis that under the Labour Relations Act they are granted a range of privileges that can legitimately be met by the imposition of special responsibilities. I continue to hold this view, so there's a balance. If you get privileges, you must have responsibilities. A second issue that deserves consideration was whether the provision created an unnecessary overlap with the provisions embodied in the Regulations of Gatherings Act of 1993. The constitutionality of the Act and its application to trade union activities was considered and upheld in the important case of Sitawe versus Jarvis and others, 2012. The court stated that the Act was, and I quote, designed to protect members of society who did not have the resources or capacity to identify and pursue the perpetrators of riot damage for which they sought compensation. And that's a key element of the Jarvis judgment. You can protect members of society when they can't find the individual who burned down their car or their business. When a gathering imperils the physical integrity, the lives and the sources of livelihood of the vulnerable, liability for damages, this is from the court judgment, arising therefrom had to be borne by organizations responsible for setting in motion the events which gave rise to the suffered loss. Martin Bradley SC further elaborates. Under the Gatherings Act, restrictions and prohibitions were imposed upon gatherings and demonstrations that caused riot damage to third parties. Under Section 11, riot damage of this sort gives rise to a claim for damages suffered by the victim against the organizer of the gathering or demonstration unless it can prove that it took all reasonable steps to prevent the conduct in question. The section obviously overlaps in some small measure with the provisions of this bill drafted, but the overlap is far from coextensive. Damage caused to person and property by strikers in the course of promoting the object of the strike need not necessarily occur in the course of the actual gathering. Indeed, much of the harm is caused often surreptitiously to strike back breakers at their home or on their way to work. A whole bunch of people pitched up at your house and burned your house down. We saw that happen, well, was it a month ago? One of the trade union leaders in South Bend had their house burned down because of this internecine fight going on. I think, therefore, that there's an independent role that this proposed amendment can play. Besides this, I believe that there's an educative purpose in incorporating such an amendment into the Labour Relations Act. It teaches a point if you put it in the bill. and the purpose reminding registered trade unions that they have responsibilities as well as rights. The amendments to my bill proposed by the parliamentary advisers go further than I contemplated by making contraventions of the prohibition a criminal offence. This conflicts with the fundamental objective of the Labour Relations Act, which is to decriminalise activities arising out of collective bargaining and collective action. I can see no reason why this principle should be flouted in the present case. Any breaches of the prohibition that constitute unlawful conduct under the Gatherings Act or Common Law can be prosecuted under the Gatherings Act or the Common Law. I can see no reason for the elaborate set of strictures suggested by the parliamentary law advisers to me. The object of the proposed amendment is to protect employers, striking workers, and innocent third parties, such as the motorist driving past or somebody on the pavement, from loss suffered by reason of injury to personal property. It is not, and I repeat this, it is not designed to outlaw hostile acts in general, such as bearing of arms, which can adequately be dealt with under the criminal provisions referred to. I thought anxiously about the merits of my original proposal, which I should say I discussed with experts in the field before putting it forward. I cannot see any reason to depart from this original stance. What was said in Jarvis has not affected my thinking, nor has it been affected by events in the labour relations field since I originally made the proposal. The very contrary is true. Marikana does not mean we don't need this bill. Marikana means we need this bill even more. Support for the bill. And I'm almost done, Chairperson. After gazetting in the Government Gazette, I received many submissions, letters of support, and one petition. I believe the committee members all have copies of all of the submissions. There were three submissions which opposed this bill. One from Kasatu and two of the trade unions affiliated to Kasatu. The other trade union federations, I don't believe, have currently got any objection. I received no objections from NACTU or FEDUSA, no objections from CONSAWU or Solidarity or so on. The points that are raised in opposition to this bill in the three submissions from the Kasatu and their affiliated unions are basically four. Firstly, the bill is unconstitutional, is a statement that they've made. As a result of the Constitutional Court's ruling in the Jarvis v. Sitawi case on the 13th of June 2012, I believe that the question of constitutionality has already been answered by the Constitutional Court. They've said that you can do what this bill basically aims to do. The second objection is that it's against the ILO resolutions to limit the right to strike. Well, this is just not true. Limitations to the right to strike have been supported in other countries and have been approved by the ILO. The ILO itself, while it doesn't in a single one of its resolutions formally uphold the right to strike, does uphold the limits to the right to strike in essential services. If minimum service systems are in place, if public servants exercise authority in the name of the state, such as the judge, if strikes are purely political direct action, and strikes decided systematically long before negotiations take place, so if there's no bona fides in the strike, or in the case of an acute national emergency, such as a massive breach of national security, or public health care, the right to strike is not absolute, but relative to other people's rights, such as personal safety. Three. The third objection is that it conflicts with the Gatherings Act. There is no specific conflict. In fact, it complements the Gatherings Act. No specific clause is ever listed by anyone who objects which conflicts with the Gatherings Act. They never refer to a clause. It's just a general statement that it's got a conflict with the Gatherings Act. This is vague and generalized complaint without any legal basis. The fourth objection is that this bill aims to bankrupt trade unions. A certain Mr. Patrick Craven loves that argument. He keeps saying it on the radio every time he argues with him. That is like saying speeding fines are implemented just to bankrupt motorists, while ignoring the purpose of the speeding fine is to control the traffic and save people's lives. The argument is absurd that this bill is trying to bankrupt trade unions, because otherwise we would have to say that traffic fines are just there to bankrupt motorists and enrich the government. And I don't think anybody in this room would be happy with that. Finally, Chairperson, at the end of the bill, as it states, there are no input. That's my submission. And I would just ask an opportunity for advocates, Giles. Sorry. I'll leave it to you to introduce our team, if that's okay with you, Jesus. Thank you for my time.
My pleasure to introduce Graham Giles, who's been an attorney for over 50 years, practicing in the area of labor law. Graham is a director of the Work Science Institute, which does research into, in particular, the area of work and labor law. Mr. Giles is an author. He disseminates, and most of you in the labor law field will know, the blog or the email Giles file, so you've all read that and understood it. And he's at the forefront of labor research in South Africa today. And I hand over to Graham. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and the members of the committee and those present for allowing me to address you. I do appreciate it. As Mr. Ollis said, the ILO does not actually recognize the right to strike. And there's a fierce debate going on at the ILO at the moment. And one of the issues is whether employers can ask employees to contract out of the right to strike. In other words, when you employ somebody, can you say to them, I want you to agree now that you will not take part in strike action? This is a hot issue that is being debated in South Africa and overseas, but it doesn't concern this committee at the moment. And let me please place on record that...
Just a second. Yeah. My sincere apologies.
Yes.
Can you take a break for such a minute?
Certainly.
Thank you.
and they ordered each of the employees to pay 214.50 rand per month and ordered that that money be deducted from the wages of the employees until the full 1.5 million had been recovered. And that covered the losses that the company suffered, excluding the losses for damage to the buses, because the court said that was covered by insurance. But strictly, the company could have, or the insurance company could have recovered that loss as well. Now, it's important that that is what is happening. I see the purpose of this bill to prevent that from happening. Why should we allow this to happen and then land up in court where people are ordered to pay money or they may lose their jobs? The trade unions are then ordered to pay, and we only have to look at the Cape Times this morning. Union faces 15 million rand lawsuit. Construction firm to take case to court over violence and damage. Yes, there may be remedies that are available, but surely the purpose is to try and stop this from happening so that we don't land up with these issues going to court, costing lots of money, and obviously at the end of the day it's the lawyers who benefit because they earn their fees out of it. Yes.
May I just interrupt and ask the other bit of questions about what he just said, or must I wait for him?
No. Let's allow him to talk, and then there will be time for questions.
Thank you. That's really all I want to say, is that as Professor Du Toit has indicated, it's a question of what limitations do you impose? We already have limitations. So it's a question of where you set that limitation to protect everybody, to balance the interests, and hopefully to stop disputes from going to court, which then costs an awful lot of money and take a long time to resolve. So I think that's all that I... Perhaps I should just add one comment which is amusing to me. In America, the baseball industry went on strike. So they had for years gone to private arbitration, and the baseball owners didn't like the way the arbitrators were resolving the matters, so they decided to lock out all the baseball players, and there was a strike. And President Clinton actually threatened to declare baseball an essential service in America to force the party to go back to arbitration. It would be like the president in this country declaring rugby an essential service, or soccer an essential service. But, I mean, the fact that the president was prepared to go that far in stopping a strike, because of the damage it was doing, all the little hamburger sellers and all the people that sold programs were being affected, so he actually threatened to stop it. And I think the other interesting point in America is that the president does have the power in the national interest to stop any strike and order a mediator to be appointed and report back to Congress, and that stops the strike for 60 days pending the outcome of that report. So we don't appear to have that sort of power for anybody to actually stop a strike in the national interest or any other interest, and I think this bill would go some way towards addressing that problem when it becomes necessary. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Honorable Ollis, I will not allow questions. If you want to add, because he is the gentleman is here on your behalf, but I will not give you an opportunity to question him. But you want to add something, or you want to elaborate on what you are saying, you are still welcome.
Thanks, Chairperson. Mr. Giles introduced me to this case this morning because it's very recent. This Labour Court of South Africa and Port Elizabeth judgment that he referred to. And what he has made as the point, which I wanted to emphasize by asking him a question, is the bill that I'm proposing, if it is implemented, may actually reduce the costs to trade unions, because they may not have to go to court for further actions that have occurred. So if the bill is introduced, the court on certain occasions when a strike has become filed may declare the strike as protected and refer parties to arbitration, which may stop the violence, which may lead to less costs being awarded against the federation or the trade union concerned in terms of the Jarvis case and the Concord ruling and the Gathering Act. Because if you stop the violence, less damage occurs, less payments then are extracted, less legal fees may be involved. So it may in fact reduce not only the violence, but in terms of a case like this one in Port Elizabeth, if you could stop the violence, you can then reduce not only the violence, but also the legal fees and the damages that get awarded later. There are copies of this case available for the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you to the speakers who have just spoken. We will give an opportunity to the parliamentary legal advisor.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Lomthan Lomfikashe. I work in the Legislative Drafting Unit. Indeed, we assisted Mr. Ollis in drafting the bill to ensure that it conforms to the style of the drafting legislation in South Africa and to also check on the constitutionality of the bill. Mr. Ollis indeed came to us and he already spoke to the legal opinion that we gave him, but I just want to also speak to it. We looked at the bill and the first thing that we considered was whether the bill was constitutional, and we found out that the bill is not unconstitutional. It does not go against the spirit of the Constitution. And the bill contains no provision that would render it a unconstitutional or a money bill, as in the Section 214 of the Constitution. So Mr. Ollis is indeed within his right to introduce this bill in Parliament and for the bill to be debated in this committee. And the other thing that we looked at when we considered the bill was whether there was existing legislation or whether the bill is in conflict with existing legislation. And we found out that the bill is, what the bill proposes is already provided for in the regulation of the Gatherings Act in Section 11. I will just read Section 11 of the Gatherings Act just to for the committee to understand what I'm talking about. That section is titled Liability for Damage Arising from Gatherings and Demonstrations. Section 1 reads, if any riot damage occurs as a result of a gathering, every organization on behalf of or under the auspices of which that gathering will occur, or if not so held the convener, a demonstration, every person participating in such demonstration shall, subject to subsection 2, be jointly and severally liable for that riot damage as a joint wrongdoer contemplated in chapter 2 of the Apportionment of Damages Act of 1956, together with any other person who unlawfully caused or contributed to such riot damage and any other organization or person who is liable therefore in front of this subsection. Subsection 2 says, it shall be a defense to claim against a person or organization contemplated in subsection 1 if such a person or organization proves that he or it did not commit or connive at the act or omission which caused the damage in question, and that the act or omission in question did not fall within the scope of the objectives of the gathering or demonstration in question and was not reasonably foreseeable, and that he or it took all reasonable steps within his or its powers to prevent the act or omission in question, provided that proof that he or it forbade an act of the kind in question shall not by itself be regarded as sufficient proof that he or it took all reasonable steps to prevent the act in action, in question. For the purposes of a report against or contribution by any person who or organization which intentionally and unlawfully caused or contributed to the cause of any rights damage, or contribution by any person who or organization which is jointly liable for any rights damage by virtue of the provisions of subsection 1. Any person or organization held liable for such damage by virtue of the provisions of subsection 1 shall, notwithstanding the said provisions, be deemed to have been liable thereof in belief. The provisions of this section shall not affect in any way the right under the common law or any other law of a person or a body to recover the full amount of damages arising from the negligence, intentional act or omission of delict of whatever nature committed by or at the behest of any other person. That is what Section 11 of the Government Act provides. So we at the unit are of the opinion that this clause 58A1 at the base is already provided in the Government Act. We base our opinion on the decision of the Constitutional Court, which Mr. Oliver referred to, in the matter of South African Transport and Allied Workers Union and another workers' covers. This case was decided in 2012, and it was a result of a class action that Mr. Oliver also spoke about in 2012, whereby people's property was damaged because of a gathering that was organized by SACAO during the security strike union. In this case, what was challenged was Section 2, 11(2) of the Government Act. In paragraph 8, the court confirmed that the Government Act aims to afford victims effective recourse where a gathering becomes destructive and results in injury, loss of property or life. It is important to know that even though this was a strike action, the Gathering Act was the applicable legislation in this matter. It is therefore that it is the basis of our opinion that is provided for Mr. Ollis. We drafted a proposal and we submitted it to him to make this amendment subject to the Gathering Act to accommodate the clause where it is proposed that the Labour Court should have the power to declare a protected strike and unprotected strike. That was the only concern we had about the bill chair, and I will use it to the committee to vote for the bill and to put the decision on the board. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Our legal advisor. I will give an opportunity to the department, the DG, to say something.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and the Honorable Members. When we look at the audit deal, what came to our mind is that the purpose of the deal is to deal with what the Medlab project is currently facing. You remember that at Medlab, you remember that the president made an announcement that the British president will give the stakeholders, social partners, through a discussion looking at managing workplace conflict and bringing stability to the region. So there was a labor relations in Daba, and thereafter there was a labor relations declaration which has two focal points. One is the issue relating to minimum wage, and the second one is the issue relating to bringing stability to the labor market. And precisely that part deals with issues related to strike and what happens with strike and violence. So, at the moment, there are two tasks that I've met. One is dealing with the issue of strike, of the minimum wage, and one is dealing with the issue of strike and violence. there is no provision in law which encourages and condones violence. So the law that are interpreted practice, it makes it illegal for people to to be involved in acts of violence. So the Labor Relations Act is clear in terms of what is the procedure. Now, what the discussion at NetLink is currently looking at is whether the legal provisions that we have in the law currently, which relate to Section 150 as amended by the Labor Relations Act now, which gives the CCMA the responsibility to intervene, especially in matters that have a public interest, which is a point that is contrary to what the attorney was mentioning, that there is no law in the country that says if there is any matter that is in the public interest, that CCMA or anybody can intervene. The CCMA can intervene, and the way the new amendments are structured now is that the CCMA can intervene even though there is not a single person who has contacted the CCMA and asked the CCMA to. So if the CCMA feels that this matter is in the public interest, they have a right to intervene. Now, the discussion that is currently at NetLink relates to whether the current legal provision is adequate to limit a strike, not to an extent that you don't have a strike that takes weeks or months. Where do you stop? What are the key determining factors that will allow you, or that will allow the people to strike? So there are a number of options that have been put on the table, which are currently being discussed. Issues relating to others have proposed issues relating to interest arbitration and all this. So this issue that Mr. Olison raising, the Honourable Member Olison raising, is a matter that is sitting at NetLink. But I want to come back to a point that because we raised the bill raises a point with regards to specifically Section 158 of the Labour Relations Act. You remember that when we brought the amendments to Parliament, the Labour Relations Bill had all the provisions that Mr. Olison proposed. And Parliament rejected this provision. And Parliament rejected this provision on the basis that the Labour Relations already allows any party to approach the Labour Court for any interdict or interim. Directing the performance of any particular act. So there are remedies in law. That was the reason why this section of the bill was not accepted by Parliament. But secondly, Chairperson, the SAMU case, which was at the Constitutional Court, provides the country with a jurisprudence when it comes to this matter. And I think the legal advisor has indicated that, and also the attorney mentioned the court, that what once the judgment has been made, you don't necessarily have to amend the law because it becomes the law. And therefore, anybody who feels aggrieved can then go to court and seek legal recourse, using the judgment that was handed down by the court. So the department views that views the presentation by Mr. Odis in two ways. One, we have the view that in terms of the law, we think that adequately covered is the point. Secondly, the discussions at NetLink, they will, if there's a change in the the different views that are going to be expressed by the different members, if the consensus on the need to change the, to amend the labor legislation, that will be done and that will come to pass. So I think that in a way the bill preempts the outcomes of the next process. So I know in terms of the current bill for the rights, use of the rights, that the youth welfare bill that it preempts the outcome of the discussions that are taking place at the cabinet.
Thank you, CJ. Members. Honorable Bakre.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to address you. I'm going to address on a couple of issues, and if you may just bear with me. Just first of all, to answer the DG, and the answer is a simple one. Yes. It is the opportunity to take trade unions and the amendments to court every single time. And we've just seen this case of 3 weeks ago in Port Elizabeth, which took into court, won the case, and now forced every single member to pay back the money that had been lost, and the legal costs, and of course the costs to the judiciary. The real issue is if we have an amendment like this, we can avoid going to court every time. So the argument you're giving is completely fallacious. What you're saying is make the lawyers rich. Make the workers poor, make the lawyers rich. Go to court every time. There is a strike, go to court every time with damage, and with those damages you claim it against the employees and you force the employees to pay it back. So the argument is wrong. And the bottom line is the unions then, in cases like this, are using their members as cannon fodder, because in this particular case, the members have to pay the damages off their salary every single month. Unless you think they're earning too much anyway, that's fine. But what you're saying is, in terms of Section 158, you reject it, and of course Parliament rejected it last time, specifically because it is an avenue. You can go to court. Now, as a lawyer, that's great, that's fantastic, let's leave it like that, let's litigate for kingdom come. But as a person who's interested in fairness to the members of the workforce, that can't be true. That's the first thing. The second DG I must address you on is, yes, I know Ned Black is talking about it, and yes, I know Ned Black is talking about the minimum wage, but then we shouldn't be talking about a minimum wage in this committee either. That is a fallacious argument as well. This committee specifically has to talk about a minimum wage because that's what we've been engendered to do. I want to then go through some of the other issues. I apologize, I address you, Madam Chair, through you to the DG, both those points. If I may go on a bit further, 3 days ago, a man who most of us know, Chaplain Matthew Sposer, said to the Austrian Business Chamber in Johannesburg, he used to be the ANC Treasurer General and he was then Mpumalanga Premier, so we all know him. He said that in South Africa today, there is instability, and it's the lack of policy instability. It's the lack of policies that we have the problem in this country. He then went on to outline in Johannesburg, in front of the Austrian Business Chamber, exactly what it was, and one of the issues was the instability in the labour force. Now, when we look at it, we need to see how can we avoid headlines that Attorney Giles referred to us this morning. This morning we opened up the newspaper and the big bold headlines, union has to pay damages, and then you read on and the members also have to pay damages. We want to avoid that. We don't want the international community to see it. And as the Department of Labour, I believe that you're looking for labour stability. And you would agree with Mr. Matthew Stover that at the end of the day, South Africa is suffering and we don't want that suffering. We're not challenging the right to strike. I saw the Kasatu input. And the Kasaja input had a whole lot about how this is a challenge to write a strike. I think all of us around the table, hopefully all of us around the table, agree there must be a right to strike. I know that the ILO doesn't have a right to strike. In South Africa, we've gone one step further in the right direction. We have a right to strike. It's in our constitution. It's intact. It'll never be changed. What we're saying is that that right must be exercised carefully and judicially. And it's the unions who have to ensure that the right is carefully instituted. They need to ensure that people are properly monitored during that strike. Now, I believe that the amendments of this nature that the Honourable Office is bringing would put that pressure on the unions to ensure that we're not in court, that we don't have damages, that we don't have a bad view in South Africa. I strongly believe, Madam Chair, that at the end of the day, this would help us. It would help the employees. It would help the workforce. Maybe the unions won't be that happy, but the workforce will be. They won't have to pay the damages that are coming up. I just want to address you on one other little issue that arises out of that. And that is, every time a rightful strike takes place, a legal strike takes place, and people misbehave, those people are then filmed by the management. It's a common practice, you all know about it. They're filmed by the management, and thereafter, whilst on a legal strike, they then face the disciplinary inquiries and get dismissed. Hundreds and thousands of people in South Africa get dismissed because they took part in a legal strike and misbehaved during the legal strike. And unfortunately, people who have been there for 20, 30 years at the workplace on a legal strike do get dismissed because the unions have not monitored the behavior. And unfortunately, at the end of the day, people come back and say that I was on a legal strike, I don't understand what happened. The reality is, if we had an amendment of this nature to the Labour Relations Act, we wouldn't have those mass dismissals that we've seen. You've seen it every single day, and I'm sure the department knows about it. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for allowing me for the opportunity to address you.
Thank you, sir. I think let me correct one
thing. Let me correct you, Honourable Buckley. What we are doing as the committee about the national minimum wage is totally different from what you are doing. The national minimum wage that the public hearings, we are doing public hearings, and it's a decision that has been taken by the committee that we must also go out and listen to workers, so that when the issue comes to Parliament, Parliament does not just say yes, we agree, or say no, we don't agree. But at least Parliament would have done its own research from the public as to what is that they would want to see. We are making ourselves ready, we are not holding our hands. But on this issue, it is only you, it is DA, it is not the committee, and you are coming up with a bill to address the issue. And the DG is saying this matter equally like the national minimum wage is there. If you brought this matter in front of the committee and say, let's also deliberate on that issue and research on it like we are doing on the national minimum wage. That's not what we are doing. So I don't want you to put the issue of the national minimum wage with the committee with this bill. These are totally two different things, even the processes. So that's the only thing that I wanted to clear. Your hand is noted, Honourable, but I will start with Honourable Mantashe. Then I'll come with, and then I'll teach you.
Thank you, Professor. I want to start by saying, for some other people, it is maybe great pleasure to table this bill in front of this committee, because maybe they have forgotten history, that the black workers of this country, prior to the introduction of the Labour Relations Act of 1995, were not allowed to belong to women. And as far as I am concerned, this bill seeks to reset the achievements of the country, because they never suffered the pain of the activism. And again, the person, the latter speaker says the union may not be happy with the proposed bill, but its members will be. And for me, that's neither here nor there, because a union is a union because of its members. It is not a union because it has leadership. From where I'm standing, the person, I'm convinced that it is proper that the consultation at the level of NEDLA, where it is consultation with stakeholders of the Department of Labor. And for me, there's no rush. May as well wait and see what the stakeholders are saying, because we are convinced that the Gathering Act is covering what the view of the GA is.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, let me first sympathize with Honorable Olive, because he was saying it took 4 years plus for this to come to the committee. Unfortunately, we've just finished a year as this committee is a new committee. Yes, we are continuing from what the previous committee was doing. But I don't think this committee has delayed your submission. We dealt with it timely after it was submitted to us. Secondly, Honorable Onis, in his input, is citing a survey of COSATU, which reveals that a sizable number of shop stewards of COSATU believe in violence during strikes. Another side of that coin is to say, why are the workers going on strike? Are they given what is due to them? And if I heard him correctly, he said, in order for them to exert pressure on the employer, they end up resorting to violence. Not that we are condoning violence, but I don't think it's a correct perspective. It is not taken to its finality, because the matter was discussed by COSATU Congress, and the view of COSATU Congress was that even that survey was incorrectly conducted. So let's take that to its conclusion, not leave it halfway by quoting what Ms. Assessing. There's an overemphasis on saying registered unions should be made responsible for damage to property during strike action. To a person who is standing from a distance, who was not there when the idea was crafted, it's a clear indication that weakens the registered trade union by making them liable. We all know, as we are seated here, that during industrial action, there's no guarantee that 100% of people that are in that action belong to the registered union. Some of them may not be members thereof. But what makes me happy is the input of the attorney. The attorney is saying there's absolutely nothing wrong with labor laws of this country. Then if there's absolutely nothing wrong with them, why amend them? So I think he's in a way agreeing with us. There's no need for this amendment, because I'm quoting him, he said this morning, there's absolutely nothing wrong with the labor laws of the country. But he went further to say he's agreeing with the bill. To me, I'm seeing a contradiction there. Chair, we have processes here. We have the NEDLAC process. We have public gatherings Act, which is currently in place, they really address what is addressed in the bill. So I want to end by saying, let us not duplicate what we already have. Let us fix with what we have. Allow NEDLAC to finalize this process. In the meantime, utilize what is captured in Section 58 as articulated by the legal advisor. Where I'm headed, I don't see any need for this amendment. Thank you, sir. Honorable American?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, everybody. Madam Chair, I'd like to respond briefly to the assertion made by Honorable Mantashe with regard to black people who were not afforded union rights and belonged to trade unions, etc., before 1994. That is actually incorrect, Madam Chair. In 1979, the Rian Commission, instituted by the apartheid government after 1973 Durban strikes, have brought out a report that was completely contrary to the expectations of the government of the day, that provided black workers in this country far more rights, labor rights, than what they had politically. Just as a start. Well, I think with regard to the bill that we have in front of us, Madam Chair, in 1918, that's just before the First World War, the Labour government in the UK had a clause in the Constitution, which is called Clause 4, which pronounced the Labour Party's support for the mass nationalisation of the key industries and banks and whatever else could be nationalized in Britain. And that remained part of its constitution for a good number of years. Now, within the context of 1918, but before the First World War, the economic conditions in Europe was in such a state that it made perfect sense for the Labour Party to adopt that particular clause or that particular position. Fast forward to 1997, when Tony Blair was the leader of the Labour Party, recognized that in order for the Labour Party to defeat the Tories who were governing after Margaret Thatcher and John Major, realized that something radical needs to take place to make the Labour Party move more to the centre and to attract more votes in order to win the election. And he took a radical decision in proposing at the Party Congress in 1997 to do something about Clause 4. And what they did, they then subsequently took a huge risk and scrapped Clause 4 of the Labour Party's constitution. And we all know the rest is history. Tony Blair went on to win the election as a result of that. Now, I consider this particular amendment to be as radical as the scrapping of Clause 4 in 1997 in the United Kingdom. Because I believe, Madam Chair, that the Labour Relations Act of 1995, as amended, is the holy grail of the ruling line, the ANC, the South African Communist Party, as well as the SARU. And we don't want to tamper too much with that act. You know, whatever changes we want to bring about are simply just, you know, a tinkering here and tinkering there, so that we don't want to disturb the equilibrium that exists within the line. And if I feel, Madam Chair, if we support these amendments, it will bring about a radical shift in creating the stability in our economy that many potential investors, current investors, businesses should complain about that. Because this amendment seeks to protect the individual, protects the worker who becomes a victim of violence perpetrated by fellow employees. And so we need to consider we need to ask ourselves the question, to what extent are we willing to make that radical shift, ensuring that we bring about changes to our laws that will have a positive impact on the economy, create jobs, create stability. And this particular amendment, although it is not perfect, contrary to the assertions by the trade unions, because of course they act in their own interest, will bring about that stability. And therefore, Madam Chair, we should seriously consider, you know, although it is not perfect, it doesn't limit the right to strike, it will create sort of a stability in our economy. And therefore I support, and I urge my colleagues to support this particular amendment.
Honorable Constables, I've noted I think from my side, Honorable Owens mentioned in his input that the proposed bill was presented on the 5th of October 2014, and he didn't indicate where else the proposal has been published, stated. The reason why I'm stating this is I know for a fact that the broader community don't have access to this. And if you look at the people who are usually partaking in the strike, in most instances, majority of those people won't have access to this gazette, and it might be that majority of them didn't see it. And if we look at the objections also as being stated in this package as being delivered by Honorable Ola, and also the support base that's been documented, we see that there's no input from NATO or FEDISA, and I would state that that doesn't necessarily mean that silence means consent. But on the other hand, if we look at the support base, it's clear to me that the people who's usually going on strike didn't make any proposal, whether positive or negative, with regard to this proposed bill. And I would therefore say that to me it's just a small fraction of the community that's actually being affected, that will be affected through the implementation of this bill. They did see the bill and did comment on it. Also, when we look at the proposals made or the support base, we wouldn't, it is individual. And it's not necessarily stating from which affiliation they come. For instance, that they indeed workers and in which areas or sections are they, or departments or sectors that they represent. So therefore we can't conclude that based on the proposals or submissions that have been provided before us, that is the majority view.
and can be accepted as that. Also, I would like to concur with Honorable Mantashe and Honorable Lolliway in stating that the gatherings, regulations of the gatherings, has already captured what is entailed in the proposed bill, and that would, I would like to see also that the necklace process needs to be concluded before any amendment to any bill should be made.
Before you, Honorable Olive, I just want to welcome Honorable it's good to see him today in the committee, because we only see him when we're debating. We never see him in the committee, so you are welcome.
Declare the strike unprotected because of the violence that forces the arbitration. In terms of what you're discussing at NEDLAC, I've got several points to make, Chairperson. The first one is that the arbitration envisaged by the Minister, which she proposed to NEDLAC, is compulsory interest arbitration when a strike becomes economically damaging to the country. That is going to fail the constitutional test. It's going to fail because an acute national crisis is not, oopsie, the mining companies are losing money. That's not an acute national crisis. Violence is an acute crisis when over nearly 100 people have been murdered. That's a crisis. Mining companies losing money is not a national crisis. So the minister's proposal for compulsory interest arbitration is going to fail the constitutional test, because the constitutional court is going to have to weigh up whether losing money is a national crisis, and they're going to say no. This bill does not say that. This bill says you can only force arbitration when there is extreme violence, and that is the point that I want to make. In terms of the NEDLAC process, yes, well, this bill, of course, predates the NEDLAC process. Maybe the Minister read it and quickly rushed to NEDLAC, I don't know. But the point here is that we do not have a voice at NEDLAC. I do not have a voice at NEDLAC. I don't have a representative at NEDLAC. Only government, which is not my party, has a voice at NEDLAC, plus the social partners. But I did a courtesy, Chairperson. I sent a copy of my bill more than a year ago to the chairpersons of all the social partner groups, business, labour and government. And the lovely people at NEDLAC didn't bother to even send me a note saying I've got your thing. That's how much they care about our input from Parliament. Not even a little note saying thank you, I've got your email. Nothing from all three houses. Secondly, we were not invited, even as observers, to your event in Ekurhuleni. I eventually got an apology 3 weeks ago or 2 weeks ago from the new acting CEO of NEDLAC saying it was an oversight. After we were promised an invitation, we were not invited. Somewhere our invitation got lost, and we now just got an apology. Thirdly, I'm not allowed to go present this bill at NEDLAC. I'm not even allowed to appear at NEDLAC. Parliament cannot go and give input. As far as I'm aware, certainly we can't, as the opposition, give inputs to NEDLAC. We're entirely excluded from all NEDLAC processes. The only thing we can do is when you send us, like you did, the draft bill that has been argued out of NEDLAC, we're allowed to comment on it and make amendments here. That's all we're allowed to do. We're not allowed to give any input. So I make absolutely no apology for tabling this here. This is my job. My job is to table new proposals here for government to think about. And then finally, my final point on NEDLAC is the whole point of this process, if you read all the documents of how the new process works, once this committee decides that the idea has merit, not the text, the idea has merit, it goes through a parliamentary process where Parliament must then endorse that, saying yes, the idea has merit. And guess what they do with it? They send it to NEDLAC, because we are not the government, we are the opposition. So we are not allowed to table at NEDLAC a proposed bill. This committee has to decide that the idea is merit. Then it has to go to Parliament to ratify, and then it gets sent to NEDLAC. The only way I can get these ideas to NEDLAC is if this committee actually says this idea is merit, and Parliament votes that it has merit, then it gets sent to NEDLAC, which also throws out that argument that came in the Kisoshi response that says we're going around the back of NEDLAC. We're not. The only way I can get it to NEDLAC is through this process. It's exactly going to go to NEDLAC, and NEDLAC will then put it in their process to basically decide whether wording is good, whether the wording is not good, whether to change it. Then it only comes back to start the usual parliamentary process. That's the unfortunate thing of being in opposition. You have to go through the whole process. So forgive me if I'm starting the process here. This is the only way I'm allowed to legally start the process. To start it right here. In terms of people, not workers without a strike, not getting access to this bill, Honourable Chair, that just simply isn't true. every single one of the trade union federations has a copy of this bill. We got responses from COSATU. We did not get responses from Nafia Producer, but they have got copies of this bill. Now, if they hide the bill from their own members, we surely can't expect Parliament to force that process. I can't speak on behalf of workers who are members of those trade unions. The trade union leadership who've got copies of this bill must give it to their members and get their members' input. So, in fact, the very opposite is true. The people who do go out on strike have got access to this bill because we sent it to them. If they fail to distribute it, we will have to take it up with them directly. But honestly, I can't ask for them. Ordinary workers who go out on strike have had access to this bill. So, that's all my point. The gatherings are not addressed. Events organized in pursuit of the aims of a strike that are not part of the gathering are not covered by the Gatherings Act. Suspending declaring a strike unprotected and forcing arbitration effectively is suspending a strike. The court does not have the power to do that, and I'm asking that the court be given power to do that. Neither of those points is in the bill used in Parliament at the Department of Labour. They are not on the table at NEDLAC. I can't get them on the table at NEDLAC. This is the only way I can legally do it. And the social partners of NEDLAC and all of those trade union federations have seen this document and have had the opportunity to comment. I've gazetted it. I've sent it to the relevant stakeholders. I also sent it to the business organizations and the NEDLAC stakeholders, as I said. I can't circulate it any more widely because I'm only one member of Parliament with limited resources. I can't massively advertise it in the paper. The government can, but really we have followed exactly the correct process, which is why it took me 5 years. It took me 5 years because the process is so darn difficult. So thank you for your time. I appreciate everybody listening, and thank you to everyone again for the opportunity. I have made my point. And just one last one. Can we request the committee to research the issue of staff violence?
No, just that one aside. You can bring that one at a different time. Let's deal with it now. And, hey, I'm looking at the regulations of the Gatherings Act. I'm looking at Chapter 4. I'm looking at Clause 11.1, which says, liability for damage arising from gatherings and demonstrations. 11.1 is saying, if any riot damage occurs as a result of a gathering, every organization on behalf of or under the auspices of which that gathering was held, or if not so held, the convener. B is saying, a demonstration, every person participating in such demonstration shall, subject to subsection 2, be jointly and severally liable for that riot damage as a joint wrongdoer contemplated in Chapter 11 of the Apportionment of Damages Act of 1956. This is contained in the Public Gatherings Act. So I am not sure when the Honourable Ollis is saying what the proposal of the bill is saying is not contained in the Public Gathering, because it's collective responsibility as well as individual responsibility in the regulation. It's clearly outlined in Chapter 4. So that's why I'm saying, why are we repeating what is already in place? Members, is there anyone who wants to speak? So just before you say something, you know, Honorable Ollis, we must not be made to feel apologetic by the fact that we are governing. We are governing, the ANC is governing. And the process of government is through democracy. Now, this process that you are referring to, of you as DA, you have nowhere to go, you can't go to Netland. As DA, you are part of the collective. You are part of parliament. There is no process that the ANC as a party or any other party for that matter that takes to Netland. We all go to Netland through this process. So please, whatever you want to say, indeed, the ANC is governing, but the ANC is a democratic organization. If it wasn't, all these processes that we are going through, or the processes that we are exercising, we're not going to take place. So as member of the committee, you have the right to call NEDLAC. We call NEDLAC at any time. We ask NEDLAC to come and account to this committee. So it is not true that we have no voice or we can't tell NEDLAC what to do. We can as the committee. NEDLAC is an entity of the Department of Labor, and they are all accounting to you here in Parliament. And that's the right that you should use, and you are using it now and again. So we don't want you to hear you when it suits you that you have no say in NEDLAC, when you can call NEDLAC and account here. But also, the responsibility given to the deputy president by the president, I think you must make a distinction there that it is not the minister, it is the deputy president. So it is not the minister, you are saying that the minister maybe saw and then ran to NEDLAC. It's not like that. So I think let's go through this process. Respect each other. We respect you. We give you a chance to speak. We allow you to speak whatever you want to speak, but be sensitive.
Thank you. Yes, I don't want to get into a legal argument, but I think it is important to note that there are two legal opinions as to what the definition is of a gathering and whether the Gatherings Act, there are two legal opinions on this table, whether the Gatherings Act is applicable or not. If this committee wishes to explore further, it might be worthwhile to do that. But I certainly don't agree with what the legal advisor said and what Honourable Anyway has said. So I don't want to get into the night. He's looking to spend here another 2 hours arguing about that. But I don't think that's the point. The point is that strongly believe that at the end of the day, the Gatherings Act does not apply in circumstances of this nature and might partially apply, but we need to actually then cover further strike action, sometimes illegal strike action. And that is seen in that they have hundreds of court cases every day. In the Labour Court, they have court cases, in the High Court, they have court cases. And the reality of the situation is they have to go to court every time to have it declared. So I think it's important for this committee to understand that there are many different opinions as to how the governing of the
Any more help?
Honorable Ollie? Just to clarify, Chairperson. The only process open to the opposition to send a proposal to NEDLAC is this one. That was my only point. I can't go to NEDLAC and argue my case. This is the only place I can, and I'm doing it. And that's why this is a proposal invited. Because I'm not allowed to, even when we summon NEDLAC, I can't across the table hand them a draft bill and ask them to process it. I'm not allowed to. The law prohibits me. This is the only way that I can propose something that goes to NEDLAC.
Thank you. Another question.
Just
Okay, I think that that's two things that one was mentioned by the honourable member and also by the honourable member colleagues. You asked the Department of Labour to comment on the proposal. So my comment was purely based on what the input we achieved and what the process that we're in also achieved. Now I would like to disagree, sharply with honourable colleagues when you say the issues that you raised in here are not part of the discussion at all. They are part of the discussion. And I also want to make this correction that the minister proposed the compulsory interest arbitration. The minister did not do that. I'm correcting this and hopefully the media will also figure that there were basket of issues that were put in a basket, and everybody said let's look at this and that and let's check over the network and check out all of the stories. The minister has not made a proposal on what would be applicable. In fact, if you look at Section 150, the minister is having student through the CCMA. Now you making a statement that says the labor court must be given power to enforce application when strike to become violent. In the new amendment, the CCMA does not have to wait for the strike to become violent. The system has been given power to intervene immediately, and I think I explained this, that it does not even require any of the parties to approach NetLeg. NetLeg can do so because it is provided for in the law. And I think this provision was put in place in anticipation of a regular situation that if you do not intervene, the strike may take long and then there will be violence and all of that things. In order to prevent all this, the people may be given those powers in the law immediately in government. So I would like to say, Honorable Chairperson, that the issues raised by the Honorable Ollie, I would like to assure him that indeed they are on the table that they discussed at NetLeg. And the possibilities of whether the interest, compulsory interest arbitration will work or not, those are things that we currently discussing. And finally, when the product is ready, it will obviously be brought to Parliament. The Parliament to give an indication of whether what we're doing with that or not. And we will definitely be requested to approach the Parliament. So I want to assure the honourable member the issues are there. They are going to come.
No, Chair, saying that we have all reflected on this, I wanted to state categorically that as the African National Congress, we reject this thing because we still have covered in the gathering.
Any more hands?
No hands. Oh, you want to say something, Ms. Ambassador?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to elaborate why we said what the bill proposes is covered in the Gatherings Act. When we did that, we looked at the definition of gatherings in the Gatherings Act. And Mr. Ollis's bill, Section 68.1, it says, when a trade union has expressively or satisfactorily stated, called, endorsed, supported, or ratified a strike or collective action. A strike is defined in the Labor Relations Act to mean the partial or complete consistent refusal to work or the retardation or obstruction of work by persons who or have been employed by the same employer or by different employees for the purpose of remedying or addressing or resolving the dispute in respect of any matter of mutual interest between employer and employee. And every reference to work in this definition includes overtime work, whether it is voluntary or compulsory. And our thinking when we said what the Bill 62 is already covered in the Government Act, why? Because we looked at the fact that when you go into a strike action, you must get a permission in terms of the Gatherings Act. And in the Gatherings Act, a gathering means any assembly, concourse, or procession of more than 15 persons in or any public road as defined in the Road Traffic Act 1989, or any other public place or premises wholly or partly open to the air, at which the principles, policies, actions, or failure to act of any government, political party or political organization, whether or not that party or organization is registered in terms of any applicable law, are discussed, attacked, criticized, promoted or propagated, or held to form pressure groups to hand over petitions to any person or to mobilize or demonstrate support for or opposition to the views, principles, policy, actions or omissions of any person or body of persons or institutions, including any government administration or government institution. That is, this definition was actually, we looked at it when we said that this is covered in the Gatherings Act. Because this says any number of persons that go to a particular place, as Ms. Olive is saying, that what if people go into someone and then someone's house. That is covered also, we can say that that is also covered by the civil, any person has a report in terms of civil law to go and see that person in a court of law. And then if it proved, even in the government, if it proved that the union was responsible or the state to take action in terms of the gathering then, which would authorize the gathering in the first place. And the gathering says that if the union failed, and which is what the basis of the Satao case was saying, that the union has failed to take reasonable action, and then those people whose property was damaged, they should be compensated. This is what the Constitutional Court said in the Satao case and the Gava condition.
In the case of the House of the President of the Union that has recently complained, we have not been saying that it was an outcome of a strike action. So they could not go to court.
Members, I don't see any hands, meaning that we have come to the end of our discussion. I really want to say thank you to you, Honorable Olive, as well, to give us an opportunity to learn more about the Gatherings Act. So that when the NEDLAC process is concluded, we are more wiser. Because at the end of the day, this is going to come in front of the committee, and you have a right, we have a right as a committee, to deliberate on the outcomes of the NEDLAC, on the issues that they are dealing with. And as the committee, we respect all the processes that are taking place in NEDLAC, and we will be patient and wait for the outcome. We also appreciate the fact that you are here personally to come and grace this meeting, not only to sit here, but to make us understand more on the bill that was put in front of us, and the fact that the bill that was being proposed is preempting the outcomes of the NEDLAC, because as we are seated here, we don't know what is going to come up. But as you have said, all these things have been taken into consideration. Thank you, Madam, from the legal section of Parliament. Your presence and your contribution has assisted us. And all of us, I think, even the manner in which we have conducted the meeting, it was in good faith. No, now, no, it's no, 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 no. I asked everybody, no, you know, don't start, Honorable Ollie, please don't start. Please don't do that. I've told you that I'm concluding because I've given everybody chance. And no, this is conclusion, and I'm not allowing any further discussion. I know that you're opposing, but it can't be.
Chairperson, can I just ask you to record your decision for the minute?
No. Don't tell me that there is this meeting has everybody to do. We don't have to be told by you whether the minutes are recorded. You know that you're the committee secretary. The decision is that I have not even concluded. The next thing, you are being disruptive. You know, you are being disruptive, and then you are going to go out there and discredit all of us and all what you have been saying here, but you are disruptive. You can't even wait for me to finish. You know? Thank you so much for the contribution. And whatever that has been said in this meeting, I think all of us have taken it in a good spirit. And the decision is that the bill is rejected by the committee. You want that? A division. You can call for a division.
If you could just please record our votes, then we have a formal decision.
Your vote is?
My own personal vote is in favour of the bill, obviously. I can't speak for other members, so you need to speak for myself.
Okay. That is recorded.
I vote in favour as well.
Sorry? Okay. No, it's fine, but the majority, what counts here? Yeah. Oh, Honorable America. Okay, you can't vote. Okay, you remember it. Okay, no, so that's fine. Yeah, no. So this, yeah, the. Okay. 3. Honorable Loliwe. Honorable Manjase. Honorable Pansalve. And myself. So the bill. Oh, there's another honorable here, of course. Honorable, you are also an alternate, so you cannot vote. Yes, you don't have power to vote. You are an alternate. You are not a full member. Oh, I'm told you are. Or if the other parties are here, I'm corrected, so you have the right to vote.
Well, I will reserve my vote until I have consulted with my caucus.
Thank you. So the bill is rejected, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
I don't know how to make our